Exhibition number 16808, Reel 13.
So, as I say, we're talking now in a sort of a past tense, and as my father used to say, anybody can be wise after the event, but at the time you see a situation as you see it. And Bobby Peel comes up and says, well, do you think you can knock a few of them out? Well, I thought, well, not immediately, as I say, you're wiser later. So, of course, that's all right. So we moves up, our three Cromwells, up onto the ridge, Mr. Lowinger, so that made four Cromwells. And we starts having a pop at these Mark IVs and these odd Panthers that were amongst them. And so because Mark IVs were basically a lighter tank than our own regarding strength of armour, and we were firing at them from the side, from the flank, so we were able to knock them out, and which we did. But they were moving, several of them fired back, but being on the move, firing on the move, they never hit any of us. We having the advantage of being firing from a hold down position on top of a hill or a slope. And but the funny thing was, they kept moving. They didn't seem as though they were inclined to stop and deal with this, which at the time I thought rather strange. But anyway, they carried on and eventually got to the point where they're nothing to fire at, you see. So we sat there, and there were several of these Mark IVs which we'd knocked out. And it transpired in later on that what had happened, the reason they were moving and appeared not to want to bother with us, you know, they didn't seem as though they wanted to stop and retaliate, which seemed to me they should have done, and if they had it done, we'd have been in dire trouble because there was a lot of them. And apparently it turns out afterwards that what had happened, these Mark IVs, as I believe, were the 9th SS Panzer Division. They were the Hitler Youth, I believe. And they'd been shifted out by Churchill tanks supporting some infantry previously, nothing to do with their little battle, although it may have been connected with it in a higher situation, but not immediately apparent to me. But I didn't know nothing about this until afterwards. And these infantry had put in an attack on these German positions. The Churchills had come up, and of course a Mark IV with the 75, basically the same as what we had, couldn't knock out the Churchills head on, you see, because Churchill's got about 8 inches or so of armour on the front. And so they were in the same position as we were with Tigers. If you fired at a Tiger with our 75s from the front, they just bounced off. Even at 100 yards, you still didn't get a penetration, you see. So these Mark IVs, when they come up against these Churchills, were in the same situation. And so they'd had to retire from the situation. And the Germans decided that wasn't good enough, that they'd got to resettle it. So they sent them back with Panthers amongst them, with their big squeeze 77s or whatever they were, knowing that they could deal with the Churchill. And that was what was happening. They were in the process of returning to renew a battle that had no connection with their episode, you see. And we were just unfortunate that three troop happened to go up onto the ridge at the same time as they were going through the valley, and consequently had two Cromwells knocked out, because in my opinion they'd gone up with such impetuous manner that they hadn't been cautious enough. They'd just driven up, you know, we'd never been in action before, it was all exciting and new, and you're sitting in a tank, a nearly 35 ton tank, and you do sort of have a false sense of security, you know, you don't realise that you can be bashed out the same as anyone else, not until it happens, you see, then you become cautious. And this is what had happened. But anyway, this is what happened, and then the weather broke, we had some rain, it became miserable, and Bobby Peel had phoned up and decided that the squadron was stuck. One troop and HQ troop were stuck because of this ditch. Three troop had virtually ceased to exist as an operating troop. And we were now bogged down in liaison with what was left of three troop. So that was two troop taken care of. And then four troop comes up and starts reporting back from the bridges. So on the strength of what four troop reported, they decided to withdraw our squadron, you see, and we'd been up there about 3-4 hours, I suppose. And so we were ordered to pull out and return back to our starting point, as you might say, which meant coming back through the town and back to where we came from. So we did this. Well, obviously, with us being up on the slope, we were going to be the last troop to be pulled back. And so one troop, an HQ troop, went back, and we started coming back. And I suppose Mr. Lowinger, he would be like an individual. He'd just trundle off and do his own thing, you see, follow the other two troops back. And we, as a troop, went back with Mr. Hobson in the lead, Sergeant Mann following behind, and me behind him, you see, as the junior tank you take up, which is really, I suppose you might say, the most dangerous situation, the dangerous position. It was a routine thing, really. So that was the situation. We're motoring down back from the slope, and we were facing with our turret to the rear, so the tank's going one way and the turret's facing back towards the enemy, you see, if any show up. And we were getting down towards the town, and Mr. Hobson was on the point of going in amongst the eight buildings and that of the village or town. And suddenly, there's somebody jumps up in the corn. It was a big cornfield we were in, waving his arms. And I got my binoculars and looked. And it was obviously some of the chaps of the crews of these two knocked out Cromwell, you say, but you couldn't see who they were. So I reports on the BSAT to Mr. Hobson. I said that situation. I said, and I'll go back and pick him up, you see. I never thought that I needed to ask his permission. I just assumed that it was a natural thing to do, to go back and pick him up. Well, I got no reply from Mr. Hobson, and which has nothing to do with his operator, because it was the tank commander who operated on the BSAT and the the IC. But I got no reply from Mr. Hobson. But then after the normal length of time you would allow for him to answer, and he hadn't, Sergeant Mann, Jack Mann, he comes up on the BSAT and he says, "I heard that, Baker." He said, I'll stay where I am while you go back and see, pick him up, I would say. So he stopped, tore it to the rear, basically to give me a bit of covering fire if anything happened, I suppose. And we motored back. Well, it was Albert Coulson. He was the sergeant of number three troop. And there was four of them, actually. Now, whether they were all out of one tank or they were four chaps out of the two tanks, I don't know. But Albert Coulson was one of them, and he was the troop sergeant. Now, he was badly wounded, and two of the others were badly wounded. But the fourth one was a lad named Hipkin. Now, he was totally unarmed. So I climbed out my turret to the back of my tank. And, of course, as I probably said, Cromwells are ideal for carrying infantry or casualties because they're flat-backed, you see, totally flat. They don't slope like a Sherman, you see. They're totally flat. And there's lots of handles for the plates that cover the engine where you've got these handles that are sunken, you see, but you can pull them up to use, which can be pulled up and used to hold on to, hang on to, so you don't get flung off if it's a bit rough ride. So it was ideal for this situation. So I get sent on the back. Albert Coulson, Hipkin is helping these other, Albert Coulson, two who were wounded, helping to get them up on the back. So between the two of us, Hipkin and myself, we get Albert Coulson and the other two onto the back of my tank. And while I'm sort of settling on, saying, well, you better lay here and all this and the other, Hipkin thinks it'll be quicker for him to run round the front. And the front of a Cromwell is like a tiger, it's in steps. It's easy to virtually walk up the front, you see. But we're standing there facing the enemy, as it were, because we'd just driven back. And the guns are pointing forward. And Denny Wells had been firing the Beezer machine gun, which meant it doesn't have a jacket on. And when you fire it, the barrel is red hot. And Hipkin comes up the front of the tank, puts his hand on the, initially, on the big barrel of the 75, which came to hand first, and then as he gets further on the front, he gets hold of the machine gun barrel. Immediately makes himself a casualty because he burnt his hand, you see. But anyway, he comes round the side of the turret, gets onto the back with the others, and we turns round and motors back. Now, I can't turn my turret to the rear this time because I've got four people on the back, you see, so we just motor back, hoping that there's no Germans looking, or if they are, they take pity on us. But anyway, nothing happened except that we drove back. Now, Jack Mann, seeing me coming down the slope, down the field, immediately assumed, well, everything's all right, so he carries on and disappears into the ruins of the town, you see. Well, we get down into the buildings and we're rocking and rolling over the rubble and the tanks sliding this way and sliding that way as the debris and masonry and that roll moves underneath the weight of the vehicle, you see. So your tank's sort of going sideways. You're in a bit like a ship in a rough sea, basically. They're hanging on the back best they can. And we're gradually getting through the town. And we get to the point where there's a track leading, well, like a little, really not like a track, leading out of the town, over the brow, back to where we came from, you see. And it was a wall of like a building, whether it was a chateau or what, I don't know, but it was a wall about 10 feet tall, a good solid stone wall, and this end of it, as we were coming to it, was a big, had been a big gate which had blown, gone, disappeared. And so you're left with two pillars each side of this thing, you see. But we're going to pass the left-hand one as we face it and go up the right, left-hand side of this wall onto this track to go back, you see. Well, Benny, my driver, he's aiming to drive past this pillar, you see. And at the last minute, the masonry and stuff we were going over, the tank slid to the right. And before Benny can dip his clutch or do anything, he's up this pillar, you see. And the engine stalls, and we're stuck there. And the tank's at a slope from the back to the front. The front's higher than the back, you see. And because of the weight of the vehicle laying back, it couldn't disengage the gearbox. And we were stuck there, you see. So now I'm stuck there. We can't start the tank up. We can't, well, we can start the engine up, but we can't move the, can't disengage the gearbox. So we're stuck. And I've got four wounded blokes on the back. So I thought, well, that's right shambles, you know. Anyway, fortunately, there's a troop of four Bren gun carriers come down this track. And I jumps out of the turret, runs across and gets under this track, flags them down. And it turned out there was an officer in charge of this troop of carriers. And I explained the situation. So he detailed one of his carriers to take Albert Coulson and the other three lads back to a first aid post, you see. So that meant I got rid of these four wounded blokes, which just left me stuck where I was, you see. So we get on the radio, Bill Barnett, Bill Bagley gets on the radio to HQ troop, you see, and tells them our situation. Well, in the meantime, of course, number four troop down the river, having given all the information, had been told to come back, and they were on their way back. So Bobby decides that because they were coming back and going to come through the town, there would be no need for our recovery vehicle to come down to deal with my situation. He said all that's needed is for a four troop, to, when they come through, to come to your help, you see. What he meant was, the thing we used to do was to give me a bump, take the weight off the gearbox, you see, by another tank coming up behind it and pushing it, and then it could dip the clutch, release the gearbox, and we would be free to carry on Norway, you see. And it meant we'd got to sit there until they got there. And so we sits there, you see, and by now the Germans are counter-attacking. They were devils for this. They never used to sort of feel that they'd lost the day. I always felt, well, it's just something temporary and we're coming back. So they were counter-attacking in the town and bullets were flying everywhere, you know. And I'm sure there was as many Germans there as there was 15 Scottish. Anyway, we had to totally shut down while we were waiting for the four troop to come up. And, of course, what's saying, Bill Bagley, he's in touch with them, you see, on his on the ASET. He's in touch with the four troop and describing their situation and this and what we would want them to do when they got there, you see. And eventually they appeared through the rubble. And I see them through my periscope because by now it was, even I, green as I was, realised it was a bit dangerous to have the flaps open. So by now we were totally shut down, you see. And I see them coming up through the rubble. So of course I comes out and one of the tanks was allocated to come and deal with the situation, you see. Now we used to carry two blocks of wood on these Cromwells. And they were like mini railway sleepers. And must have been oak, I should think, because they were hard, heavy wood. And they were about 3 feet, perhaps 3.5 feet long. About 10 inches across and about 5 inches thick. And we used to use them for bumping one tank with another, you see, in between the tanks. Because sometimes you couldn't bump them because the tracks would meet and you couldn't do it, you see, so you used to get these pieces of wood. They also served a purpose for when you jack up, if you wanted to jack up something, you could put the jack on it, you see, so the jack didn't go down into the ground. A variety of reasons for having these two blocks of wood. But one of the things was bumping, so as this tank was coming up behind, on a Cromwell you had the exhaust system, you had two big fishtails in between the double skin at the back with a cowling over the top, because we had an aeroplane engine in a Rolls-Royce converted Merlin engine. No, it was called a Meteor, being adapted from a Merlin to use in a tank, and it was called a Meteor. And it was the same engine actually, you see, but well, being an aero engine, when you started it in a low gear and you revved up, you used to get these carbon deposits fly out the exhaust, you see, and they used to come out in the dark, they used to glow like glowworms. So they used to have this cowl over the back, right across the back, so that when these carbon deposits came up, they immediately hit the cowl, dropped back, and immediately died a natural death. They just went out, you see. But if you hadn't got that cowl there, you get about 15 feet of sparks flying up in the air, you see. And so it made it more awkward because I had to lay over the back of this cowl and got my knees at the back of it to stop myself sliding completely off the back and holding this piece of wood hanging down at in the centre of my tank, you see. And this other tank came up, and what he's got to do was gently come up until he was touching the end of the wood, take the weight so that I didn't have to hold it any longer, and I could get back onto the back of my tank so that if the piece of wood flew up in the air, it probably wouldn't hit me, you see. And I'm looking, and it was a chap named Johnny Rowlands. He got killed later on, Johnny did, who was driving it. And I didn't find out until years after the war, actually. I mean, I would have known this at the time, but you don't remember everything, every little detail, you see. But I always remember it was Johnny because he was an old terrier, same as I was. And so when he came up and touched it, and, you know, and I gave him the old V for victory like we do, and he gave me one back, and laughing like, because of our situation, our predicament, ridiculous situation. And so when they got the piece, well, he came up and got it, and I said, "Go on in, put your foot down." So of course he put his foot down, you see, and pushed, and immediately my driver knocked it out of gear. And so as Johnny then rolled back, the bit of wood disappeared, and my tank rolled back, and we were freed, you see, to carry on, which we did. I didn't find out till years afterwards, after the war actually, that it was Reg King, the troop sergeant, who it was his tank, Reg King's tank, you see. He was the troop sergeant. But I always remember it was Johnny Rowlands who was the driver. But I never ever remembered until we were talking about it years after the war, that Ray, we were talking, reminiscing, and old Reg King said, "Remember when we come, we got you off that bloody pillar?" And until he was telling me, I never knew, I never remembered it was Reg King who was the tank commander. But anyway, that got us out of the situation, and we rejoined the squadron. And that was the day finished.
This is the 26th?
On the 26th of June, you see. That was our first day in action by one squadron, A squadron, of the two squadrons that were there, you see. C squadron had not been involved in this. And that ended the day, you see. And the other casualty was our second in command was Captain Rainsford, Wyville Rainsford, whose father was Colonel Rainsford, and they were the local squires out at Milton Mouser, just out of town, about 4 miles out of town. They were the local squire family of Milton Mouser. And he was our first casualty, and he was killed before we actually got into the town. And they said a sniper, but as I think I've related before, they were not really snipers in the true sense. It was simply a German who was an opportunist to be able to see a tank commander with his head out, and he shot him. You know, it would just be an ordinary German soldier who took an opportunity that presented itself to him, you see. But when we went in action this first day, all this time we'd had a week or 10 days doing nothing. Of course, we heard all information come round. Our intelligence officer got information from units that had been in action and giving advice, and they said, well, we ought to wear our steel helmets, you see. So this first action, when we were going down, moving in, we put our steel helmets on, which was most peculiar because they didn't fit properly with the headsets on and all that, you see. They weren't made to wear on top of a headset. And they were clumsy, you know, and cumbersome. You thought, well, I feel like a prat, you know, wearing this. Anyway, before we'd actually got into the town, up there on the radio, and old Bill Bagley, my operator, tapped my foot under the tank, which we used to, it's a habit we developed to communicate, you see, because he was on the A set in communication with the senior Sunray in command, which would be the squadron leader, and he got to tell me, you see. So instead of flicking over from one set to another, in my case, from the B set to the A set, he used to tap me, or if I wanted him, I used to tap his ankle underneath the breech of the gun, you see, the main gun. And, because, I mean, when you're sitting in a tank, our feet are only about 18 inches apart, so I just put my foot out and tap him, or he taps me. And he tapped me, you see, and I looked across, and he lifted one headset, one ear off, you see, and he said, Rainsford's just been killed. He said, sniper at him. So I said, well, already? I mean, it's a bit of a shock, you know, because we weren't expecting to do any fighting, really. And here we were, the second in command of the squadron had been killed, and we hadn't even fired a shot yet. So that meant off come the steel helmets, because he was wearing a steel helmet, and if a sniper had killed him with a steel helmet on, there's no point in us wearing them. So, of course, we took our steel helmets on and put our berets back on again, you see. We never wore steel helmets ever again. And he was the only one that I've ever been involved in actual a burial. You know, I mean, although we had chaps killed afterwards, I was never involved in recovering them and burying the bodies, you see. That became the job of the padre, and he had a working party of some sort. They had to deal with that. And but in this case, the squadron pulled out. Of course, Rainsford had been killed, but he was still in the tank, you see, with HQ troop. And he remained in the tank, and the tank went into action with the troop until they were withdrawn, you see. But then when we got back, and all this business and my business was sorted, and we got back, and the thing was that he was going to be buried, you see. And they dug a grave, and it was under a wild apple tree. It was in a hedgerow, and there was this apple tree there, and it was in full blossom, this apple tree. And, well, I suppose it was crab apples, really, but it was a wild apple tree. as compared to being in an orchard. And we dug the grave. Bobby Pearl said, we'd dig it. So he said, it'll face the sun when it rises in the morning. So we dug this grave, and it's the only one that I've ever been involved in. But the thing was, the mess that it had made of his head. And when you think of people who had head wounds, serious head wounds, that recovered from them, I've thought since, if he'd have not been wearing that steel helmet, it's quite possible he would have had a serious head wound rather than having his head more or less smashed up, because with the bullet coming in a steel helmet, it couldn't get out because it was encased in a steel helmet. And I think it did more damage to his head through having a steel helmet on than it would have done if it had had his berry on. I've always thought that. I mean, I might be totally wrong. It might not have made any difference. But his head was totally smashed. And I've always thought that it's possibly because he was wearing a steel helmet. But anyway, he was our first casualty, and that happened before we even got in action, before we'd even fired a shot. But he was the only one, as I say, that we actually buried. And then, so that ended the day. Well, then the next day we carried on normally with C Squadron operating. And this operation was known as Epsom. The code name for the operation was Epsom. The object, the main object of this operation, was to secure Hill 112. Now, there have been books wrote about this, and I have one in my cupboard now, and it's called Hill 112. And it's written by a Major Howe of the infantry. And he describes this fighting of Hill 112, and very graphically, like, you know. Well, as regards this hill, it involved the 11th Armoured Division, the 15th Scottish Infantry Division, and the 4th Independent Armoured Brigade, which Pip Roberts, the divisional commander of the 11th Armoured Division, borrowed to supplement his number of tanks, you see. By having another armoured brigade, it gave him another, what would it be, three regiments, you're talking of the best part of 200 tanks, in addition to its own tank brigade and us. I mean, we, the 2nd Northamptonshire Yeomanry, were divisional troops. We did not belong to the armoured brigade, you see. And this is why we could be used independently from the brigade by Pitt Roberts in various means and numbers. I mean, he didn't always need to use the whole regiment. He could use one squadron or two squadrons. He could even use one troop from the regiment because we were divisional troops, you see. And because after Epsom had finished, he generally seemed to use us as a tank regiment allied to the brigade. And it became apparent that he was using his brigade, counting us as a 4th tank regiment. And he built up battle groups with 2 tank regiments plus a battalion from the 3 that made up the infantry brigade. And he could make sort of 2 separate battle groups on 2 separate situations, which was very convenient for him, I suppose. But anyway, when it suited him, he used us individually most of the time as a regiment, doing what's supposed to do, reconnaissance or protection on one flank or the other of the brigade, or to support the infantry. And in this situation at Hill 112 in Epsom, we'd only got these 2 squadrons. So we operated in whatever capacity he wanted us. Now, to be honest, I don't have much of a recollection of the little jobs that we did up until the night of the 29th of June, and the morning, the early morning of the 30th of June. And that was the end of the 11th Army Division's participation in Epsom. And on the next day, the division was withdrawn. Now, the only other incident other than this night, when my squadron was virtually wiped out, actually, which I will describe. Previous to that, the only other vivid recollection I have of an isolated incident was one night the 3rd Royal Tank Regiment had been up on the hill supporting the infantry.